Please the court, counsel. I am Steve Feewiger, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Knight. Mr. Knight was a prisoner who was sentenced to 4 years in prison, released early, but was serving time in Vandalia Prison when he suffered an injury to his right shoulder. It is our position, and in his 1983 action, that he suffered this injury due to a deliberate indifference to his known medical needs, an Eighth Amendment and 14th Amendment claim. The trial court on summary judgment ruled that the two correctional officers who were in charge of this detail to the work site, Officers Wido and Wiseman, did not have knowledge sufficient to constitute a deliberate indifference because they didn't know of the known medical condition.
And you would agree that it was not designated in his prison records?
I would agree with that, but I would
also... There's no work restriction
on the record, and I would agree with that, Your Honor. But Mr. Knight made everybody aware of it. He was somewhat a whiner.
Who's everybody?
He told the duty officer. Unfortunately, the duty officer was not a named party defendant in this case. But if you look at the testimony that's important in this case, both Wido and Wiseman admit that they know of the injured shoulder prior to him starting the work.
But the problem I have with that is they don't necessarily know how serious this injury is. And I'm very worried at the idea that we're supposed to place on prison guards, when there's no notation in the record of a work restriction, the responsibility at pain of Eighth Amendment, 1983 damages, of assessing the medical condition of every prisoner, when frankly prisoners are not always the most reliable or forthcoming reporters about their condition. They can try to get out of work. They can do all sorts of things. Why can't the officers rationally rely on the record and the fact that even if he's complaining about his shoulder, it's not enough?
Because the officer Wiseman admitted it. He admitted in his testimony that he told me that he had previously hurt his shoulder and that he shouldn't have even been out at the work camp. If he would have said that before we left, meaning stay in the camp versus transfer, I wouldn't have even taken him out. Wiseman knows at that point that this shoulder is serious enough to not do the work that was assigned for that day, namely clearing brush and throwing logs.
I'm not sure you have to read it that way. And actually, I just want to say, with respect to the two defendants, I think it would be helpful for us to focus separately on each defendant's knowledge and the role each defendant played. Because, for example, after he's injured, you know, when we get to phase two, if you will, of this case, after he's injured the shoulder, I think it's Wiedaw who tells him to go back down
and continue working
with the other arm, doing light stuff. He says, do what you can or something. But that's not Wiseman. And so I don't see how Wiseman could possibly be held liable for that stage of proceedings. Wiseman's off trying to fix the saw.
We're talking about the initial stage, Your Honor.
Right. I know you. I thought your brief covers three stages.
Correct.
The initial order to work, what happens after he's injured, and the way he's transported back.
Correct.
And eventually gets care. And I'm saying that the relative role that each of these two officers plays is somewhat different at each of those points.
But we're deciding facts at this point.
We're also deciding allegations. You're complaining about, for example, at stage three, this van that comes to pick them up and the fact that it makes a stop along the way. But there's nothing whatsoever in the record to indicate that either Wiedaw or Wiseman knew that it was going to stop.
Well, the fact of the matter is that they violated an institutional directive when told of the fact of the injury.
I don't know that this necessarily falls under that directive or that that's the measure of the federal Constitution.
Well, it is evidence in view of light most favorable to the prisoner in this situation, Your Honor, of a deprivation. When you have an institutional directive that says when the prisoner reports an injury, you are first to notify the shift commander, and then, excuse me, I got it backwards. You first stabilize the patient, then you notify shift commander, and then, if necessary, you call in an ambulance for transportation.
Well, that depends on whether it's a serious injury.
And
the thing doesn't require, if you break your fingernail, it doesn't require.
Well, I agree, but a torn rotator cuff is objectively a serious injury.
But they didn't know that that's what it was, and indeed the prison didn't even figure that out right away, did they? They
No.
thought it was a sprain.
Well, I mean, that's a different issue in this case that was dismissed out on summary judgment, which we did not appeal,
mm-hmm.
because what it ended up being was the court found a negligence standard rather than a deliberate indifference on the part of the medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, he's informing him, I can't use my right arm. Objectively, a prison.
That was after he threw the log out and hurt.
Correct.
Re-injured. Before that time, he's 6 months away from this operation. There, I assume there's some degree of cure.
Well, I assume
maybe
so,
too.
Maybe
he shouldn't have been out there. Maybe he should have told them at the outset.
Well,
you said something about, it's not clear to me when exactly he told them. I know there seems to be some discrepancy about that. But
well, I'll read what
he said. 9 o'clock, and then he changed that.
He said, in the defendant's affidavits, they said in their affidavits that he reported this right after we got to the work site.
And they thought that was, what, 8:15 or something?
What's that?
8:15 or something?
Correct.
Like,
but in their depositions, they were questioned on this. And Mr. Weedow was asked this question. First, he was asking, did you hear what happened at the duty log station, meaning when he was assigned to go out at the work site? And he said, I wasn't there, or I didn't hear him say it, but when he got to the job site, he said it. What did he say at the job site once you got there? I believe he said, I hurt my shoulder and I can't work. Was this after he actually re-injured his shoulder working? This was as soon as we got there. Those facts, in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, show that my client reported his serious medical condition.
Well, did he say that? He hurt his shoulder?
Yeah,
he says, I don't know what he told the original officer, why to put him out at all. If he said that he had a rotator cuff operation.
No, this is Wiseman's own testimony.
Yeah, I know, but what did Wiseman, he said he hurt his shoulder. Well, unfortunately, my son comes home from football practice and said he hurt his shoulder. And so the question is, to what extent does it hurt? And we all get concerned about it, and he goes back and practices again. So the question is, what's the hurt? If it's a serious medical injury, which an operation for a rotator cuff is serious, but it also can be cured. And this was 6-7 months ago.
But he's an operation. But the prisoner who has had this operation already
still hurt.
Says, I've re-injured it, and I can't work.
Didn't re-injure it at the site then?
No, he had been already assigned previously to workstation duty.
So he re-injured it another day.
Right. Well, I don't know that for a fact.
Well, we should know it. If he's re-injured it, did he go to the infirmary or anything?
We're looking at the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Knight. Mr. Knight's testimony in this case is, I told them I can't use this shoulder, I can't do this type of work, that after he said go to do the work or go to SEG, I went down, they were yelling at me, and because I was only picking up twigs, so I did what they told me to do, and I lifted and threw a log, and I felt it rip. And that's in the light most favorable to the non-moving party on summary judgment standard. That, coupled with Mr. Weedow's admission that he says, I've hurt my shoulder and can't work, and that he said it as soon as we got there, gives them the objective knowledge necessary to know that they're putting him at harm's risk by assigning him to these work duties.
Now, is that when he told him to go back in and work with one hand, or is this after he threw it?
No, this was before.
Okay, and after he threw it, he told him to use one arm.
Correct. That was Officer Weidau again also.
Right.
But again, Officer Wiseman saying he shouldn't have even been out there. But he still made the subjective judgment to let him continue to work, even though he wouldn't have taken him out if he had been told that up front at the time of the work assignment. So we believe that we've overcome our burden of showing knowledge and showing that they had a deliberate indifference based on the fact that they have told him, go to SEG or work, and gave him no choice to either be punished or to risk the re-injury. Thank you.
Welch?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welch. I'm here on behalf of the defendants. In fact, the narration that the plaintiff's counsel has given is not in the record. And first of all, I want to say plaintiffs relied many times on Weedow's deposition. That deposition is not in the record. And even if we put it in our appendix, though, to show that the plaintiff is mischaracterizing that, because if you look in our appendix, you will see that that what he says is, he says, I hurt my shoulder and I can't work. What was your response? I told him to go sit in the trailer. So, and that was as soon as they all arrived at the thing. So the dispute is about whether the re-injury took place as soon as we arrived, you know, right after the work started, or it took place at 9 o'clock, as the plaintiff testified. But if the re-injury took place at 9 o'clock, then that means that the delay in getting to the treatment by 10:45 isn't 2.5 hours; it's only 1.5 hours. So plaintiff can have it both ways. Either the re-injury happened at 8:15, as the defendants say, pretty much right after they got to the work site and work had started. And interestingly enough, plaintiff himself says, he testifies, how does it go? At page 42 of his deposition, as soon as you get there, you start working right away. So as soon as you get there means, as soon as you get there, you start working. The re-injury happened then, and he was told by both officers to wait for the van. So that's what happened, and that's when he told them, I hurt myself, and, you know, I had this prior injury. And their response was, both defendants said, my response was, go wait for the van.
No, he says in one case, at least, Weedow ordered him to go back down there.
Right, okay. So let's go back to the beginning.
Well, that's what he said.
Right. No, I mean, we accept that because this is summary judgment. So what happens is, plaintiff testifies, as soon as I get to the site, I start working. I'm picking up twigs. They're yelling at me to do the harder stuff. Plaintiff never testified. I told them when I first arrived that I couldn't do the work. It was only the only time he ever says he talked to them before the re-injury is when they said, look, you've got to start doing this. You've got to start picking up the heavy stuff. He said, I told them I can't do it. He doesn't say he told them why. He just told them I can't do it. They yelled at him some more, plaintiff says, and so I did it. I ripped my shoulder.
Now, these are in his deposition, and that is in the record.
Correct.
And what did you say was not in the record?
Officer Weedow's deposition is not in the record.
No, I saw you mentioned that on page 23 of your brief, and what I'm not clear on is whether it was never designated as part of, say, the summary judgment process, or whether somebody just went up into the attic and found it, or, you know, exactly how this comes to be not somehow in the record.
It wasn't attached to anybody's pleadings. I mean, I actually was surprised. I mean,
but the record would show that it had been noticed and that it had been taken.
You don't see it in the district court's decision. And I was puzzled, frankly, about this. And I asked our trial counsel where it was. Mm-hmm. He said it's not attached to anything, and then he gave me a copy. Because we, you know, we of course had a copy. But
that's what I mean. I mean, right. In the course of of the pretrial proceedings. There was a time that the deposition was taken. The
correct.
State was,
correct. But it wasn't before the district court.
It just
court.
Hadn't been designated in some special way as part
it
of the
summary judgment. It wasn't
submitted
to the district court ever, right. But I will say that the plaintiff, that Officer Wiseman's deposition was before the district court, and his deposition says exactly the same thing in terms of the order of the events. It says, the plaintiff told me about his re-injury. What was your response? I told him to wait for the ban. So it's obvious that regardless of whether the re-injury happened at 9 o'clock, as the plaintiff says, or at 8:15, as defendants say, the re-injury happened, and the response to that re-injury, when plaintiff told the defendants about it, was that go wait in the van. So it can't be that they knew about his injury, his prior injury, before, because the I told everybody about my injury doesn't cut it, because it doesn't identify either defendant as someone who had been told. And in fact, the plaintiff, to his credit at his deposition, said the defendants couldn't hear me. They weren't within hearing range when I told the desk officer. So there really is not any evidence in the record that the plaintiff told either defendant before his re-injury that he had been injured before. And as Judge Wood said, there's nothing for them to have thought this. You can't get on the work detail if you have a medical restriction, and he didn't have a medical restriction. He didn't ask for a medical restriction, apparently, even though he told the doctor that he had this and the doctor knew it. He was on three.
He has a lower bunk restriction?
He did have a lower bunk restriction, but again, you can't be at the work camp if you have a work restriction. And he was at the work camp, ergo he didn't have a work restriction. He had gone out several times. The record, we don't know if it's 3 or 11, it's a little unclear, but he went out at least 3 times. It was always logging. He knew that. His deposition says that. He never filed a grievance. Apparently, instead, he told everybody, I shouldn't be here, which is what he said, you know, later on in his grievances. So you can't require officers to reject the objective signs. He doesn't have a medical restriction, ergo he can do this work, and take a particular inmate's word for it that he can't do the work, even if he had told them before and he didn't.
Isn't there also something that he liked being on this work?
Yes, that's the other thing. This is what he said. Why didn't you file a grievance? Well, you know, I thought I could get by doing the little stuff, and I liked being outside. Who wants to be in prison? I appreciate this. But the thing is, if you feel that you don't belong on the work camp, then you have to tell the officials and let them decide whether you should be there or not. And his not doing that deprived the officials of the ability to remove him from what he said was a danger. Now, after the re-injury, it's true, Officer Weedow, and only Officer Weedow, told him, well, go back, work with one arm. And then what does he do? He tries to do it. He can't. He comes back. Officer Weedow says, do what you can do. He goes, I can't, and he doesn't do anything more. So this transient, and again, you know, he hasn't told them. There's nothing in the record there saying, look, you know, I had this prior injury, Officer Weedow. I really can't do this. I'm in, you know, all of this pain. I can't do anything. At that point, there isn't that. He just says, I complained to them. We don't know what he complained about. I have a little pain. I can't do this. We don't know. So then Officer Weedow says, reasonably, do what you can, and plaintiff doesn't do anything thereafter. So
apparently he had worked other days.
And he had worked several other days. He knew exactly what this required. Everybody was supposed to be throwing logs, doing heavy duty. And he said, you know, I thought I could get by doing the little stuff. Well, you know, that doesn't cut it. You can't have it both ways. You can't get to be outside the prison doing on a heavy duty work camp and do the little stuff. I mean, if you feel that you can't do it, it's your obligation as an inmate to tell them I can't do this, to tell the person who can do something about it, not the duty officer, not anybody else. You tell the medical people, because the plaintiff says, as far as I know, it's the health care unit that decides whether or not people can do it. So the plaintiff says, he admits he knew what to do and he didn't do it, in order to get out of doing, you know, this what he says now and he said after was a dangerous thing. So then there's the delay of the thing. Now, as the court, excuse me, The delay, there are a couple of things. There's obviously, as the court noted, there's no evidence of personal involvement in the frolic detour that the driver eventually took. But there are a lot of other unique circumstances here that even if there were a constitutional violation, that clearly go to qualified immunity, both as to the before and after the re-injury and as to the delay. With regard particularly to the delay, there's already a van on the way. The plaintiff's injury is not serious. If the medical people thought it was a sprain, and a sprain under the internal directions is a non-serious injury, then how can the non-medical defendants here be faulted as constitutionally for not recognizing that it's not a sprain? And again, I might point out the plaintiff has not challenged on appeal the finding that a doctor didn't recognize it was a sprain. So it's really inconsistent to say that lay people should be faulted for finding not recognizing that it was a torn radiator cuff when medical people didn't notice it. So in closing, if I may, again, this is a case in which the plaintiff had the power to get out of or at least request to get out of heavy duty. Instead, he tried to get around it and do the light stuff, and the defendants cannot be faulted for his having made that choice. If there are no further questions, we ask you to affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Feinberg. Case is taken under advisement. Court of